With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom or the motherly figure in your life? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your recipient a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about, for example, your mom's life or any custom questions that you want to ask. And then she can either type her response or record her voice. And MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories forever. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Obviously, we love anything surrounding storytelling. It's what we do. So to be able to gift this to my mom, to not only hear her stories, but the stories of my grandparents and other family members, it will create a cherished gift for all of us to enjoy. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN for 10% off today. Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. When a woman's body was discovered partially undressed, strangled, and abandoned near the Green River in Washington, it was quickly assumed she had been yet another victim of the Green River Killer. Thankfully, witnesses came forward and gave accurate accounts of what happened to Barbara Jean Hagedorn that night. That information led to the arrest of a man who wasn't the Green River Killer, but a man who was out on parole for another violent attack. As we learned from Emily and Nick's conversation last week, the Green River Killer wasn't just a killer of dozens of women. He was also a scapegoat. Men who heard of the murders realized how easy it was to get away with murdering and dumping the body of a woman, especially if she was a sex worker. Not only did this lead to copycat killings, but it distracted detectives. Even if a case, like today's, accidentally resembled the Green River Killer, it was sent to the task force. Over a year ago, maybe even longer, I was contacted by Patrick Hagedorn via Facebook, where he asked me to look into his mother's murder, a murder that was initially believed to have been connected to the Green River Killer. Today, I'll be sharing case details surrounding Barbara's murder, Washington's mistake of letting the perpetrator out of prison early for previous offenses against a teenager named Jeanette, and how the violent and preventable loss of his mother shaped Patrick's life. Next week, Patrick will join me to talk about life from the point of view of a child whose mother was taken too soon and how it shaped him into the man he has become. Barbara Jean Hagedorn was born April 12, 1958, near Seattle in the Rainier Valley. Her father was a chief of the Seattle Fire Department. When Barbara was about 12 years old, her parents divorced and both remarried. Her father retired from the fire department and enjoyed his later years with his new wife. Her mother and her new husband opened a bar. When they closed it to retire, they moved to Packwood, Washington, 122 miles southeast from Seattle. There, the couple opened a grocery store, which they happily ran until they both passed away. Despite the divorce, Barbara had a fairly normal childhood. She fell in love with hula dancing and did it for years. Patrick, her son, did have a hope chest of his mother's, which contained her skirt and photos of her dancing, which sadly was stolen years ago. At 21 years old, Barbara Jean married William. It was 1979, and she was nearly 4 months pregnant with Patrick. The young and expecting couple eloped at the courthouse, hiring the guitar-playing busker from outside to play for their ceremony. That man found himself in a sports coat in the front row as he was the witness for the marriage of William, who wore a blue leisure suit, and Barbara in a floral dress. Not long after Patrick was born, Barbara began to struggle with substance abuse. When it started affecting her daily life, Bill asked for a separation, not as the first step toward a divorce, but as a break so she could focus on her health and hopefully go to rehab. During the separation, Barbara stayed in Packwood with her mother and stepfather. Bill stayed in Seattle as he was working as a truck driver for the Port of Seattle. During the separation, the couple still stayed in touch and even spent time together. From what Patrick recalled, it was very amicable. Though the couple was in talks of reconciliation, Barbara wasn't going to let her youth pass her by, and she began dating a man named Dean, who the kids would call Dino the Dinosaur. By kids, I mean Patrick and his half-brother on his father's side, who was 5 years older. Barbara's parents weren't scandalized by her dating. In fact, they preferred Dean over Bill because, in their opinion, Bill was just a truck driver, which was not good enough for their daughter. Then, just before his 5th birthday, Patrick's life was completely upended. His mother didn't come home, and his young brain would have to try to understand that she would never be coming home again.
As far as memories, I was 2 months away from being 5 when she was murdered. So I was pretty young, but I have pictures. It's not like a story or a movie I can think of memories, but I have pictures. And when my dad was alive, I'd ask him about it. And he'd be like, yeah, no, that we were doing this. And he would tell me the story. We used to lay outside. We had a golden retriever named Credence that a lot of me and mom would spend our days just out sunbathing, laying in the yard with the dog running around. At night, he worked night shift for a local glass company that makes Coke bottles and beer bottles. And she'd drive me every night over to have lunch with my dad when he went to lunch break. And other than that, it was just a pretty, from what I remember, just normal until all of a sudden it wasn't normal anymore.
What made Patrick's childhood abnormal was the murder of his mother. To get where we are today, we have to go back to June 20th, 1980. It was a bit after 10 p.m. when two friends, Janet Spearing and Grace Ramirez, were out enjoying an early summer evening drive through Kent, Washington. When they got to the intersection of Smith and Railroad, they spotted something shocking, a young, nearly nude woman running southbound. They pulled over to check on her. Hysterically, she answered them. She had been raped. They helped the 18-year-old into their car and found a phone somewhere to call for help. A fire aid unit was sent from Kent to check on the woman. She was upset. She was undressed, but she had not been seriously physically harmed. The fire guys asked the women to drive to the police station, which they did. Another report shows that this call and the aid was provided after the group arrived at the station, but either way, the woman was physically all right. It was about 11:15 p.m. when Janet pulled up at the station. Going to the front window, she told the responding officer she had a rape victim in her vehicle. The officer called it in and went outside to see what was going on. Finding the teenager in the back seat, she said her name was Jeanette. There isn't a lot of info about this case that's easily accessible to the public, so I will not be using the survivor's full name. Wearing only a shirt, no pants, no underwear, or even shoes, Jeanette was emotional and could not stop crying, as anyone, especially someone of her age, would feel after such an ordeal. She began telling the officer about how she had just been kidnapped from a laundromat and raped. With just the basics, the officer put out a call for the suspect, a white man in his late 20s or early 30s with dark hair and a mustache. He was about 5'10" and 175 pounds. He was in a plaid shirt, dark pants, had heavy shoes, and a notably large belt buckle. The next call was to David, Jeanette's husband. The station informed him of his wife's condition and requested he get there as quickly as possible, which he did. The responding officer told him to get Jeanette to the hospital right away. David agreed, asking that the officer come with them. He said he would and left just ahead of David and Jeanette. The officer arrived at the hospital 10 minutes later at 11:50 p.m. 20 minutes later, while still waiting on Jeanette's arrival, the officer got the call that the suspect was in custody. He could not wait to give the good news. When Jeanette and David finally arrived nearly an hour later at 12:40 a.m., they didn't need to hear the news. They had been the ones to break it. After leaving the station, David and Jeanette decided they would pick up Jeanette's father while on their way. When I first read that, I was a little bit surprised, but then I remembered she's just 18 years old, so that would make sense that you would go get your dad. After picking him up, they realized Jeanette was still basically naked and she needed her clothes. which unfortunately were still at the laundromat she claimed to have just been kidnapped from. That caused me to gasp at the PTSD of it all, but that was maybe the best thing they could have done. Where the laundromat once stood, there is now a closed beauty parlor called Mela's. It's a cute-looking area of Kent. There's a bit of an old town-like strip. The streets are very wide. It's right along some railroad tracks. Just kind of an every small town look. It doesn't seem too different from places like Longview or Corvallis or Bend. At this intersection, there are restaurants and a park. Near where the laundromat had been, there was also the Kegger Tavern.
Uh-oh.
Parking to grab those clothes, the car ended up in front of the Kegger Tavern on East Meeker. Looking through the tavern door, be it because it was made of glass or it swung open, which I like to picture for the dramatic effect.
Like saloon doors?
Exactly. Jeanette looked in on the bar she was too young to patronize and saw a man sitting at the bar. He was about 5'10", 175 pounds, in his late 20s, in a plaid shirt with dark jeans. She knew right away and without a doubt that this was her attacker. Just sitting there, enjoying a drink, less than 2 hours after attacking her and not more than a block away from the scene. Jeanette, David, and her father then went down the road to the location of where the rape took place. There, they were able to make a call to the police and told them about the suspect's location. Sergeant LaBelle, Officer Daughtry, and Officer Boone responded to that call. Since Boone was in plain clothes and Jeanette was strong enough to agree to do so, the pair walked past the Kegger Tavern door twice so she could get a closer look, confirming what she already knew. The man in the bar was her rapist. How amazing to have a suspect in custody that quickly. It all transpired so fast they hadn't even had time to get Jeanette's statement about what actually happened. When there was time to do so, she gave the upsetting details as to what exactly the man in the plaid shirt had done to her. Around 10 p.m. on the evening of the 20th, Jeanette went to the laundromat to wash her clothes. As she began putting the clothes into different washers, a man stood at the front door. Looking at her, he caught her attention. When they looked at each other, he said something to the effect of, "Well, smile."
Ew.
Jeanette did not engage. The man then walked into the building, past Jeanette, and out the back door. 3 minutes later, as she was still sorting clothes and filling machines, the man returned to the building. Again, she did not acknowledge him, but she was forced to when he came up behind her, wrapped his arm around her neck, and grabbed her. Putting her in a tight chokehold, the man started dragging Jeanette to a corner in the back hall of the laundromat. He said in a notably soft tone, "You better not scream or say anything, or I'll choke you to death." The next demand was for her to remove her clothing or he would choke her. She complied, pulling her pants down, even though she was struggling to breathe. He then forced her to undo his pants, but as quickly as he had started this attack, he seemed to have changed his mind, telling her to pull both pairs of their pants back up. It turned out he hadn't changed his mind on attacking Jeanette, just on the location. With his arm still around her neck, they walked down the street, past the Kegger Tavern. The man continued to warn her to be quiet. She took the threat very seriously. Any more pressure on her neck and she wouldn't have been able to breathe at all. Jeanette made it clear to the officer she was speaking to that the chokehold she was in was hindering her breathing so much so that she was certain this man was going to follow through on his threat and choke her to death. Approaching the next block, Jeanette was told that she would be let go by the time that they got to it. But the block came and went, and she still had an arm around her neck. Confused, scared, and wanting to be freed, Jeanette asked about his promise. So the man changed it. The next block, she would be let go. Then that block came and went. Then they crossed the street because the man claimed he would be catching a train in 30 minutes, which is when he would let her go. She asked him why he kept changing his mind about letting her go. He asked her to stop with all the questions. The man did not let Jeanette go. Instead, as they walked through a plot of land near the train tracks with tall grass, he threw her to the ground. Once again, he demanded she disrobe and that she take off his pants as well. She did, but just as he did in the laundromat, the man stopped her. He thought he heard voices in what he believed had been a deserted area. He peered over the grass like a lion waiting for potential witnesses to leave so he could finish attacking his prey. As the man told her to be quiet, Jeanette continued talking, mostly about her baby at home and how she didn't want to be hurt, leaving her baby motherless. By that point, she found no comfort in his promise to not hurt her, as he had already backed out of letting her go so many times. Between talking about surviving for her baby's sake and being asked for graphic details as to what happened, Jeanette needed to take an emotional break from speaking to investigators. It only took her 2 minutes to muster the strength to go on with telling her story. The man then raped her vaginally before forcing her to give him oral sex. Completing his act in that manner, he demanded she lay on her stomach. She refused, so he choked her. She did roll over, and he anally raped her. The man stood up, and for a moment, Jeanette thought that he would finally let her go. But when he stood, he spotted people in the area again, so he laid down. But not on the grass. No, he laid on top of Jeanette. Then he fell asleep.
Ugh.
She tried to wiggle to get away, but the fear of waking him was too much, so she stayed put. When he finally did wake up, he raped her again in the same sequence, vaginally, orally, anally. After the second attack, the man was tired and wasn't being as strict with holding Jeanette. When she realized she wasn't being held or choked in any way, she took off running down the street. She looked behind her a couple of times to check if she was being followed, but there was no sign of the man. That tells you he got up from that situation and just walked the two blocks into the bar, which is, well, it's all disgusting, but that, I don't know, there's something about the arrogance of that or stupidity.
I just can't believe he fell asleep.
Yeah.
That's like he had no stress in that situation.
Yeah, no worries. He's fine. Comfortable even. When Jeanette got to the end of the larger street, she stood there half dressed and screamed for help. Two cars passed and stared at her as they did. A third car finally stopped. It was Janet and Grace, the women who drove her to the station. It would only take 2 months to get from arresting this guy at a bar to getting a signed plea deal. 29-year-old Bruce Bradley Bushy was arrested and charged with first-degree rape. I did not see anything about a kidnapping charge from either before or after the deal was offered.
That might be the deal. They dropped that charge.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Or also, this is 1980, so dismissed her saying that she was taken from there. Or
it could have just went with the bigger charge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. When accepting the deal, Bruce had to plead guilty. That would allow the charge to drop from first degree to second degree rape. It would also allow for a 3-year minimum of the 10-year sentence. In his statement from the plea, Bruce Bradley Bushy said, "I am not admitting that I committed this rape, but I am pleading guilty because after reviewing the police reports, I believe there is a substantial likelihood of conviction. I am pleading because I want to take advantage of the prosecutor's offer and do not want to be charged with rape in the first degree should I go to trial."
I wish it was part of the plea deal that he had to admit guilt.
Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, say exactly what you did.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been nice. But at least they got him on that. Some of the damning physical evidence was Bruce's underwear, his plaid shirt, jeans, leather belt with a buckle. From the scene of the rapes, officers found a pair of women's underwear, a pair of women's blue pants, and clogged shoes, all of which belonged to Jeanette. Bruce Bushy was probably pretty glad that he took that deal when less than 3 years after that horrifying attack, he was released from prison in late 1983. If instead he had gone to trial and been found guilty of first-degree rape, he would have probably been behind bars for at least 10 years, and he wouldn't have been free to harm again. It was reported that even though his plea deal was for a minimum of 3 years, it was possible there was a clerical error or something along those lines that led to Bruce being released as early as he was. I'll get into this more next week, but as with most cases, there are some discrepancies. When Patrick shares what he knows next week, it's important to remember that he was a child at the time, so his information was limited. Also, what I'm sharing today, a lot of it comes from police reports, which were given by Bruce. So this is his report of how things happened. And as we know, convicted rapists aren't the most reliable witnesses. Side note here, I'm still waiting for and hoping on some documents to come through for next week's episode. But it does appear that the attack on Jeanette was not the only charge Bruce faced around this time. On one of the court documents, there were 3 lines of information regarding witnesses, which just had their names, dates, and it looks like the crimes committed against them, which connected them to Bruce. So they were listed as Jeanette in 1980 with her rape, Wilma L. for a 1978 battery, and April R. with a 1980 SIM assault, which I don't know if you guys have seen that before. It's just SIM. So I'm thinking similar assault.
Simple assault.
Oh, simple assault. Thank you. I was Googling and I'm like, I don't know what they're trying to say on here. Okay, so another assault charge, basically. So like I said, hopefully next week I'll have those documents from the state, but I don't even know that they exist because things get kind of tucked away. So we'll see if they come through. If not, it does look like Bruce had several other issues of being violent towards women from late 70s to early 80s.
A true gentleman.
Oh, yes. Let him out early. On the evening of Sunday, September 16th, 1984, less than a year after Bruce was paroled, Barbara Jean Hagedorn got into a fight with boyfriend Dino the Dinosaur. As it usually is, the stress was caused by money. Distraught, she left and spent the day with her friends. It's reported they hung out all day. That evening, she found herself in the bar at the back of the local Denny's. News articles mostly referred to Barbara as a waitress, headlines saying things along the lines of man charged in slaying of waitress, as though she wasn't more than that. However, some articles said that she was actually unemployed at the time. Patrick's understanding was that she had been working, as stopping by that lounge was part of her coming home routine, but that also could have been just her place to go in the evenings. For anyone who doesn't recall or doesn't still have lounges like our local Sherry's, some diners, such as Denny's, had back or corner areas that were blocked off to give a separate lounge feel from the restaurant. Some of them have bars, pool tables, lottery machines.
Oh, yeah. My favorite is from Corvallis, Daryl's, and they had the Amber Room.
Ooh, Daryl's Amber Room. That sounds sexy.
His parents took us there for her 21st birthday.
Oh, my God.
They went from, like, strict parents to the coolest parents ever in one night. Her dad was dancing with me to ABBA songs all night.
That's great. Sounds like we need to get to Daryl's Amber Room. It was a small space, but Barbara was not alone. The patrons ended up eventually being just herself and a man she didn't know. Right before she had arrived, there had been a couple of local firefighters hanging out. The man she didn't know was Bruce Bushy. He had gone to the bar to catch the football game. Before Barbara arrived, Bruce had been chatting with the two firemen, watching the game with them. Soon after Barbara got there, she and Bruce got to talking. The pair then took a seat at a Pac-Man table and enjoyed some drinks. It was just about closing time, about 2 a.m., when it was reported Barbara paid her tab and left the restaurant. Some witnesses reported it appeared that the two walked out of the restaurant together. Just 5 hours later, Dean would wake up and realize Barbara hadn't come home after her day of cooling off. It's unclear what the police did to help right away or how seriously they considered the report he made, but Dean took it upon himself to look for Barbara. He decided around 3 p.m. to go to the Denny's. One could assume he also knew that was a spot Barbara would have ended up at the end of the night. His instincts were right. In the parking lot sat Barbara's car. He approached the vehicle and found the doors were locked, the keys were in the ignition, the battery was dead, and her purse was sitting on the passenger seat. It was like she had sat down to start her 20-minute drive home and disappeared before she could. After finding the car, Dean went inside to ask the Denny's employees if they had seen Barbara. They told him about her being in the previous night drinking with a man who had been drinking with the firefighters. And that was all the information needed to figure out Bruce Bushy had been the last one seen by Barbara. Bruce had been so friendly with the firemen. He not only introduced himself by name, but he gave them his phone number. So when police were called to the Denny's, all they had to do was contact the nearby fire departments to find out who had the number of the man who was last to be seen with Barbara. As Bruce was the last one seen with her, the fireman said he either did something as a one-off or that man from the bar was the elusive Green River Killer. Once in contact with Bruce and informed as to why the police were wanting to speak with him, he complied, telling them that he had been at the Denny's and he had been hanging out with Barbara. When the bar closed and he walked her to the parking lot, he tried to help her with a car problem, but he was unable to do so. So he claimed he left her in the lot after she told him not to worry about it because she had a friend who was working nearby whom she could get help or a ride from. He added that he wasn't willing to offer her a ride as he had to be at work early in the morning. 2 days later, on the 19th, a man named David Lindberg was driving along the Green Valley Road around 11:30 a.m. when nature called. Stopping his car to urinate, he made his way into the woods for privacy. As he did, he spotted the body of a young woman. He left and called the police. Even though it had only been a couple of days, decomposition was already taking place. This was clearly Barbara's body. It was also clear she had been murdered at another location than where she had been so carelessly dumped. From Barbara's home to where she was abducted was just a 20-minute drive. From where the body was found, just 15. This setup might sound familiar, especially after Emily's last two episodes. At the same time Barbara went missing, Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, was prolifically active in the area. Barbara's murder fit the Green River Killer's MO. She wasn't a sex worker, but she had been out late and did have a history of substance addiction. There had been sexual activity. She was undressed, with her blouse unbuttoned and pushed up. She was strangled at a location other than where she was found. And where she was found, a wooded area along the Green River, was exactly where Gary Ridgway dumped bodies of his victims, hence the moniker. In May of that year, Gary Ridgway had contacted the Green River Task Force to offer helpful information. Because he was known as a John in the area, he was brought in for and passed a polygraph. 3 months after Barbara was murdered, the death toll for the Green River Killer was 42 known victims. Interestingly, it doesn't appear Bruce was trying to be a copycat or cover up his crime by disguising it as a Green River case. It seems he had his own MO. Kidnap, rape the victim in three manners, maybe more than once. Last time his victim got away. This time he wouldn't let that happen. Now that this missing person case had evolved into murder, detectives with the Green River Task Force called Bruce again. As before, he swore Barbara had been left, alive, at the Denny's. Not believing him, detectives got to investigating Bruce directly, starting with his workplace. That was when they learned Bruce's boss had called Bruce's neighbor at 8:30 a.m. on the 17th, about 7 hours after being seen at the Denny's. The boss had called because Bruce was supposed to be in at 6 a.m., but had called in reporting car issues. But he wasn't expected to be this late. This was a red flag to the police, as Bruce had already told them he left Barbara at the Denny's because he had to be at work, and he hadn't appeared to have any vehicle issues of his own as he did so. The neighbor did see Bruce pull up at about 10 a.m. Since it appeared something was going on, the neighbor told police he then approached Bruce when he got home. He would later tell detectives how distracted he seemed. They, along with other neighbors, also reported that on the 19th, Bruce was seen wiping down the inside of his station wagon with a cloth before washing the inside and outside. Yes, washing the inside. As in, people watched him take the back seat out of the car and hose down the interior.
That's interesting.
That would not get anyone's attention.
I would definitely record it these days.
Yes. And on that note, what you've probably noticed by now, as I did at this point, is that all of Bruce's choices are not the best. So
usually they aren't in these types of situations.
They usually aren't. But I do think by this time the police were maybe realizing this probably wasn't the Green River Killer. This guy is not a criminal mastermind. He stayed at the bar. He gave his number to the firemen. He washed the inside of his car in a parking lot of an apartment. It's not like, oh, my neighbor saw me down the street. Well, it was in a parking lot. So this guy's been accused of a lot, but not of overthinking. So he did tell the police when they asked about that, you know, why were you hosing down the inside of your car? He said that he decided to wash it after the first conversation with the police because he was feeling nervous that they were onto him.
Oh, well, at least he's honest.
Yeah. On the 20th, Bruce was arrested. They took him to the station where he called his wife before agreeing to give a statement. It was reported he was given a polygraph test at this time, but I was unable to find the results of that. Dean, the boyfriend, was also given a poly that same day, and he passed. Now Bruce's story was changing. Actually, he hadn't left Barbara in the parking lot. Now he remembered that she had actually decided to get a ride and meal with him. As they started to drive to a restaurant, he claimed that she decided instead of food, she wanted to find a bar. But it was after serving hours, so Bruce threw out the idea of them having sex. She agreed, and they drove to a remote park on the Green River, where he claimed they engaged in consensual sex in the back seat. Now see if this sounds familiar. He told the police they started with him being given oral sex. She removed only her pants and pantyhose before having vaginal and then anal sex. Because of a medical issue, spastic colitis, Barbara complained of pain and asked for him to stop. This led to a fight because Bruce didn't know what spastic colitis or just colitis meant, and that is swelling of the large intestine. Individual cases vary, of course, but symptoms can include abdominal pain, bloating, bowel issues, and much more. Patrick, Barbara's son, didn't know anything about this condition regarding his mother, but he had seen on a document a doctor did confirm Barbara's diagnosis. It seems Bruce might have thought colitis was related to an STI because he claimed to have followed up her complaint of pain with a demand to know, quote, what else she had. This exchange quickly heated and became a fight. The fight became physical when he started to strike her in the head and overpowered her, even though she was fighting back. Bruce then admitted to the police that he strangled Barbara until she was dead. He then tied her hands behind her back with her pantyhose, put her in the back of his car, and drove to the Green River. When he found a good spot, he took her body from the car and left it in the woods. When the investigators asked him how he was certain she was dead, he said, "When you quit breathing, you're dead." Barbara's body was taken in for autopsy. It was found that she did have semen present in her vagina and anus, but not in her mouth. This was an issue for Bruce's story because he claimed in his interview that he ejaculated when Barbara supposedly gave him oral sex. Also countering his tale, her hands were tied, but were in the front of her body, not back, and the tying happened before she was dead. As for the cause of death and injuries, Barbara had several broken ribs, one of which punctured a lung. She had been beaten on the head and face, and her chest had been beaten so fiercely it caused a tear to her heart muscle. The cause of death was manual strangulation. I can confirm also that the autopsy did find she suffered from colitis, and her doctor would later testify to treating it, along with a kidney infection, and the severity of both would have caused sexual pain. The friend Barbara spent the day with before going to Denny's said that her health was talked about and Barbara was having a bad pain day. All of this was extremely important as Bruce claimed the sex they had was consensual.
Yeah, it's highly unlikely she's going to be.
As someone who has had lady pain from endometriosis and a kidney infection, the kidney infection was the worst pain in my life. And I think anyone with female organs can attest that when you have pain there, not just, oh, I'm on my period, I don't want to, but pain, especially spasms, the last thing you're thinking about is intercourse. For most people, I would take a guess to say. The argument her boyfriend, friends, and doctor would make was that if she was having any kind of pain in that realm, casual sex in the back of a stranger's car or any sex at all likely would not have been something Barbara was seeking. Barbara's doctor would say she would have such serious pain days that it would, at times, hinder her ability to walk. He had even told her to abstain from sex, which Dean confirmed. It had been a few weeks since the couple had been intimate. The state had a lot of evidence, proof, and even Bruce's own story to hold against him. That's not to say there weren't some hiccups before they could even get to trial. Going back to when Bruce was arrested, it was argued since there was no arrest warrant, you couldn't prove if Bruce had come out of his home to be arrested or if the police took him against his will. Bruce's team also argued that he had not been given his rights before he provided his statement. They even alleged that the police made threats against Bruce's wife, family, and property. The court found Bruce left his home on his own accord when asked to go with the police. They said he was given his Miranda rights at the appropriate time and he did not request an attorney. But we do know how often those requests can be ignored. The state claimed the request for his lawyer came after he made the statement as to what happened in those early morning hours. Of course, the state said that they did not make any threats against anyone in order to get that statement. In the end, it was decided the arrest was legal, the statement was given after he was informed of his rights, and the statement was given voluntarily. The question regarding the Miranda rights were about the statements Bruce made as part of basic questioning, so there was actually no need or requirement for the rights to be given. So it all stood, and the state was moving ahead, pursuing the death penalty for the aggravated first-degree murder charge. His bail was set at $250,000. Bruce waived his right to a speedy trial, as part of his team was dealing with another major case at the time. When the voir dire process got underway, five potential jury members were dismissed when they said that they could not support a vote for the death penalty. What Bruce got hung up on was the fact that the charge was aggravated, which would allow for the death penalty. He and his team tried to argue it wasn't aggravated because it wasn't premeditated, but it wasn't just the planning ahead that led to the aggravation. It was that he was committing a murder while committing a rape while covering up said rape. The state presented its case. They had witnesses, including the firemen from the bar, doctors, and Barbara's friends. They had Bruce admitting to the murder. The accusation of premeditation didn't mean the state was saying Bruce had been planning on killing Barbara as soon as they met or when they left the bar. They were saying that to strangle someone with your hands, which takes 3 to 5 minutes, you are given time to deliberate. After Bruce beat Barbara so badly it ripped her heart, he had time to stop and think before following through with the minutes-long strangulation. An important aspect for the state was to bar any questioning or reference to Barbara's history of substance addiction. They did not want her struggles to be used as an out for making what could be painted as a bad decision, meaning leaving in Bruce's car, supposedly. They wanted Bruce to be on trial, not Barbara. It did help to prove their point when the autopsy showed Barbara had a blood alcohol count of 0.10 and only had that alcohol, some caffeine, and a little bit of nicotine in her system. Bruce had an argument of his own against the excusal of the 5 anti-death penalty jurors, but it was allowed as those jurors are considered Witherspoon excludables, which I really hope Reese Witherspoon uses for a band name or something cool. That allowance comes from Witherspoon versus Illinois, a decision that came from the court in 1968, which allows for the dismissal of jurors who are against the death penalty if they are being presented a death penalty case. The state wanted to be able to present the 1980 rape case due to the similarities. Because he had been caught before, Bruce knew he would have to kill Barbara as to not leave any witnesses. And if he had been caught for rape, he would have gone back to prison and probably for a longer period. So he decided to murder her and dump her, possibly like the Green River Killer, to help keep the heat off of him. This became the basis for Bruce's motive. He knew his rape of Barbara would lead to punishment, just like his last attack 3 years prior. The potential length of punishment, now that he was reoffending, would be heightened. His motive was to do whatever he had to escape accountability. For that reason, it was necessary to show the jury limited facts of his prior conviction. The state pointed out that it was well known that to escape penal consequences, a person can be motivated to commit an even more egregious crime to cover up another. Both sides came to a close, and the decision was handed off to the jury. Because I went through nearly all of the documents from this case, I got to read their inquiries to the judge. These can be questions relating to the case or themselves. These jurors asked about word usage regarding pieces of evidence and descriptions, especially evidence filed as number 44. On the list of exhibits, it's simply marked as a cassette tape. A tape player and transcript of the tape were other requests about Article 44. Reading the transcript, it's very basic, just 2 pages, mostly the detectives talking about specifics to the interviewee, asking Bruce if he knows he's being taped, the date, his rights, so on. It ends with Bruce being indisposed, so perhaps he went to the bathroom and upon his return asked for a lawyer. Proving that jurors, they're just like us. One request was, may we please be excused at 5:30, leaving at 6 caused hardship for more than one juror, which the judge allowed. And my personal favorite, may we please be allowed candy bars or Coke, etc.?
Absolutely.
The judge also agreed to that, saying, now get this, they would need a specific list and the collected funds. So you mean to tell me
they don't even supply candy?
If I take 20 minutes out of my day to give blood, I can get all the juice, crackers, cookies, chips that I want. But if I give weeks of my life to be traumatized by a murder
you
trial.
You get, what, $13 a day or
bupkis.
Something? No, they get paid. They get paid.
You're not giving me snacks?
I know.
But imagine everyone jokes about, oh, jury duty. Wouldn't it be more tolerable if you had little treats all over the place?
Mm-hmm.
Just
like a cruise?
Yes. Absolutely. They should walk into that deliberation room and it should be a full
little
spread
buffet
on the back.
Like when you
croissants.
Have like a leadership meeting, there's always food.
Precisely.
There.
Precisely.
Because you got to stay awake and use your brain all
and
day.
You're going to be thinking more.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be all cranky. You're giving people Coke and candy bars.
So they're required to bring their own Snickers bars? Like, rude.
Anyway, so I just wanted to include that because it was shocking information. Maybe nowadays, all these years later, it's better, but. On March 28, 1985, Bruce Bradley Bushy was found guilty of aggravated murder in the first degree. Before the trial even began, the prosecution stated that there may not be sufficient mitigating circumstances to merit leniency, meaning the state felt the circumstances surrounding Barbara's murder were so extreme and vile that there was no option for anything but the death penalty. But the jury did not agree. They gave Bruce life without the possibility of parole. On May 12, 1987, Bruce's appeal, mostly about evidence and counsel, was denied. couple little things here I just wanted to share. They didn't really have a spot in the story, but they're interesting. In November of 84, Robert Goldsmith, Karen Klein, Robert Kessler, and Seattle King County Public Defender Association were all granted leave to withdraw as counsel, and then other counsel was to be appointed. And this was, quote, due to the court being satisfied a conflict of interest exists. I'm not sure what was happening there, but basically all of the King County public defenders were excused.
Interesting.
Because of conflict of interest. And I'm so curious. I was digging so deep because I wanted to see if Bruce had said or done something or threatened something or...
Well, it could have even just been another case.
Yeah, that's true.
Because that happened a lot. Like when they were commuting all of the death penalty sentences to life, I feel like I read something about they were on multiple cases, so they had to be excused from some of them.
So I think that's a totally valid thing, especially how they were saying in the beginning of the trial, they waived the right to the speedy trial because they were all working on a big case somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes me think it was Bruce is that Rita Griffith, appellant lawyer, she withdrew on June 26, 1987 from his case. So, again, I don't know how common all that is. I just saw these documents in the case file and was like, huh, it seems odd that two times he had all his lawyers back out. I'm guessing it's him because he sucks.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably likely.
Speaking of when the police checked in with Bruce's parole officer, they said he was in trouble at the time, so I don't know if that means they were pursuing some sort of prosecution or anything like that. He had not completed a sexual deviancy program. So he was already in some hot water for that. And going back to when he was released, and I know we talk about, I especially talk about these reoffending people who have been released. And logically, legally, I know that it's not okay to have the parole board look at what other potential charges were. Because they weren't convictions.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not working.
I know.
Right? So it's so hard to say, hey, can we look at what the plea deal was he signed and
but
what it was
going to be? On the
other
side of it, imagine having a decision made upon you if they did consider those things
I
and
know.
You were innocent of them.
I know.
So
that's what
it's a rock and a hard place kind of a situation.
Because I feel like, okay, if we're about to put you up on parole and we see a piece of paper that says 3-year minimum and you're at 3 years, we go, okay. But if we looked at all the documents to say, here's what happened, here's what you were originally charged with, and here's the deal he took, I feel like that's almost fair, right?
Well, I mean, think about the Portland jogger rapist. He had 8 confirmed rapes, but they could only get
right.
charges on one of them.
Exactly.
And so he came out smelling like roses on paper.
Right. And to see what they did, because I don't know if they ever, well, I'll say I never saw even a hint of a charge for the kidnapping of Jeanette or attempted murder for strangling her or holding her neck for all that time.
That's why I feel like if I were a victim in a case, I would really push for all the charges.
Yeah.
Even if they are like, well, we want to get.
Right. We'd rather get him convicted
yeah.
than risk.
I
Take
would be like,
risk.
No, because if he does get out, because if this isn't a murder, it's a likely chance he's getting out. Right. Why would you want to take that chance? Like, get him for everything.
Yeah.
To protect the next person that comes along.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not how our legal system works all the time.
I know.
Well, and then there's what kind of parole is it? Are they?
Oh, yeah. He was supposed to be on, I think it was called extensive or extreme, which I couldn't find information of what that meant for him, obviously, besides having an officer and having that program to go through. But. Again, didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever that setup was, did not work because this guy, he learned from his other attack, which was, I have to kill this person.
Right.
And then hide them. That's what he learned from those 3 years.
It almost feels like there should be a charge for that, for like escalation.
Oh, yeah.
Between crimes, you know? Let's put
yeah.
that on the docket
or
to
like,
vote
yeah,
on.
Yeah, a reoffender charge.
Well, I mean, then they kind of do, like, if you're a murderer and you kill someone else in prison or
right.
then you are eligible for the death penalty in a lot of states.
Right.
So, I mean, they do something similar. So it wouldn't be a stretch to have a charge like that.
All right. Well, it's decided.
Let's,
all charges
we'll
now.
We'll put it on the ballot. Everyone will vote.
Next week, I'll be continuing the story of Barbara, but from a different perspective. I'll be speaking with her son, Patrick, He'll tell us who his mother was, what it was like to lose a parent in such a horrendous and public way, and how being so close to something so tragic has shaped his life.
Maybe slow down slightly.
Oh, okay.
Just a little.
Her father.
You little shit.
I'm just a little goof. Not long after Patrick was born, but hello.
Excuse you? Yeah,
vibrate the balls a little. And it's funny because Patrick, the son I'm talking about, he's a big fan of the show. And so I wrote him, was like, hey, normally when we work with the family, we don't do bloopers out of respect, but you're a fan. So how do you feel? He's like, bloopers. We need to laugh after a cry. I'm like, all right.
That's cute.
After leaving this. Huh?
Oh, no.
Oh, you're responding.
I said, oh.
And I did with my face. You just couldn't hear it.
I heard it. It went.
That's the Botox wearing off.
So that she could get a closer lurk. Lurk. Damn it.
I get a lurk over here.
Trash
or I get lurk a work or lurk. It. Work and lurk it.
Purp it and lurk it. That Tegger Cavern lurks like fern.
Fern.
Let's go get a drink.
I'm thirsty. I couldn't really do that one, but
can
I tried.
We get some wings? Play some darts? Or some pearl? The man. Ba-bang.
You don't even gang need bang. Us to mock you
I
at
certainly,
this point.
I can gangbang myself.
I certainly don't. I certainly don't.
Oh my gosh, could we do a BBL but my titty fat into your titties? Brian. Where am I getting that? That allowance comes from Witherspoon versus Illinois. Illinois.
What a loser.
Oh my God. How embarrassing. I can only assume this was the recorded questioning. Oh. I don't have to assume because I found that later. I'll be speaking with her son, Patrick. Oh, damn it. Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain. And suck my balls.